What should America do for the Jones? Town meeting tonight.
Greetings, town meeting friends, and welcome back to historic Town Hall in New York City for another spontaneous and unrehearsed session of America's Town Meeting of the Air. Tonight, we together consider the question, what should America do for the Jones? And now I present your moderator, Mr. George V. Denny, Jr., president of Town Hall and founder of America's Town Meeting of the Air. Mr. Denny.
Good evening, neighbors. What do you think America should do for the Jones? It would be interesting to compare your opinions just now with the opinions that you may hold after this discussion this evening. Those of you who've read the book, The Grapes of Wrath, or have seen the motion picture, are quite familiar with this family of Joes. Ma and Pa and Tom and Al, Grandpa and the rest. Tonight we shall take them to stand for all of those poor families who are driven off their dust-ridden farms in Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Kansas, and go west in search of a new start. One might even say, but for the accident of birth, there go I. What indeed would you and I have done had we been subjected to exactly the same experiences as the Jodes from birth? In these days of sweeping social, economic, and political readjustments, it's worth pondering, and pondering carefully. Whether or not Steinbeck exaggerates their subsequent fate as landless, homeless migrants, we know it's a bad one. It's bad for them and bad for America. Even as we discuss this problem tonight, more Jodes continue to roll westward over Highway Number 66. What should America do for them? To help us answer that question, four agricultural experts are here with us this evening, each of whom has had some concrete suggestion to make based on his own experience with the American farmer and the American land. Mr. Rexford Guy Tugwell, former director of the Resettlement Administration, will present the background of this problem. Mr. Philip Bancroft, a member of the Executive Committee of the Associated Farmers of California, will speak for the employers. Mr. Kerry McWilliams, California Commissioner of Immigration and Housing, and Mr. Hugh Bennett, Chief of the United States Soil Conservation, will complete our list of speakers. Our first speaker has been a teacher of economics and an outstanding authority on economic subjects, and has worked in private industry, but is better known to all of us as the former Undersecretary of the Department of Agriculture and Director of the Resettlement Administration. He's now chairman of the New York City Planning Commission. I take great pleasure in presenting Dr. Rexford Guy Tugwell. Tugwell.
I can remember as a boy in western New York how collections sometimes had to be taken up to bring old neighbors back from Kansas. Preacher or deacon, usually at a church social, would explain how ill fortune had overtaken the migrants, and would perhaps read the pathetic appeal from the West, which had set the movement going. Drought, dust storms, and crop failure, even in those days, often reduced prairie settlers to the most abject poverty. And they remembered the green fields of home with a fierce nostalgia which we sought to satisfy. In the moment of sympathy, we forgot the reason for their going, that the fields and pastures at home were running down after half a century of use. Another recollection of mine has a related meaning. It has to do with the way my father used to take me along on his trips in a three-spring wagon over the wintry Chautauqua Hills, and of how closely we were wrapped against the deep cold in buffalo robes. Everyone used buffalo robes in those days. I did not then connect the bad luck of migrating neighbors with the animal skins which kept us warm. But I've learned to do it since. The vast empty uplands toward the Rockies had been grudged to the wild herds since man's first exploration. Their skins, scattered so usefully over the eastern states, were evidence of their destruction, evidence which was only sharpened by the bad returning news from long-gone settlers. Men had not believed the warning of the Cherokees and the... Sioux that vegetation and animal life stood at an incredibly delicate adjustment. Nor had they waited to make experiment of method or of quantity. Grossly and without forethought, The well-adjusted herds had been slaughtered. The land had been opened to entry and had been quickly brought under plow. It was not our old neighbors who had killed the buffalo and sold their skins. I was just too young for that. But it was they who had plowed the land on which the buffalo had fed not long since. They failed in the first dry spell and left. New pioneers came when it rained again. Over and over, the same experience was repeated. Later on, in a new century, when the Great War came and wheat went to $2, the new tractors broke millions of acres where the horses had only broken thousands, acres which even the speculators knew to be unfit. And the end of that cycle came in 34 and 36, when the rains failed even more completely than in any time the white man could remember. Only the Indians had tales of old ordeals like this. The streams of Jalopies were enlarged, which headed toward the Pacific Passage. But they were only bigger and going in a different direction. They were not new. Man's contract with nature not to plow the grasslands had merely been violated on a larger scale than usual in the last wet span of years. And the present penalty of drought was awful merely in proportion. The grasses of the plains had survived pre-farming droughts simply by suspending life until the rains came again. And the buffalo had not been so numerous as to graze away the roots. The soil was not exposed to the gouging of the wind. Man's problem, if he was to better this relationship, was to increase the immediate yield of the grasses and not to injure the smooth, rich bed which would yield future crops. With what seems now to have been criminal carelessness, he attempted the transfer of Eastern practice to the West. This time an outraged nature had fiercer weapons than the gentle seaboard rains and snows. The screaming prairie winds reached into the broken furrows and blew the impertinent farm 10,000 feet aloft and sifted them over the whole of the Mississippi watershed. Men were not given time to reach old age and to start their sons. The penalty was imposed on the very men this time who had violated the contract. Fields lay humped and ravaged. Hard pan and sand, a bleak brown desert, lay nakedly exposed on still days when the wide prairie sky was clear. Men's goods, their houses, their barns, their machines were half buried in the drifted topsoil, and they themselves gazed hopelessly at a vast, empty, desolate land. But these were not individual offenses, and not many of us judged for long that the punishment ought to be borne by these folk alone. A nation, a society, had approved this dreadful enterprise. Every man had been led to think that he had a kind of right to a homestead on which he might do what he liked with his own. A free man on free acres. That the nation believed in as it believed in little else. These sad families of the 30s, in the west-going Jalopies, had been Bible-led people who had lived so far as their strength went, according to their lights. Their punishment left them shaken, morally confused, and no collections were being taken up to bring them back from the Dakotas, from eastern Colorado, and from Oklahoma now. They had to seek the nearest green place, and that lay over the Rockies. But California and Oregon were preempted. Those who had got there first resented being asked to share with newcomers. They had, they said, no call to meet a bill, which had begun to run before they were born. Behind all the cruelties and civil conflicts, in the valleys of the West, there lay this background of national failure. And if human nature has seemed incredibly stupid, and inhumanity to man nearer the surface there than we should most of us thought possible, there is at least this excuse for the sentiments, the beliefs, and the customs which are at conflict there with a tough reality. In California, there has been a difference established between the men of Israel and the men of Egypt. The Moses has not been found who will lead his people out from slavery, dividing with his rod the economic seas before them. But for those who live miserably on ditch banks, or more luckily, in the federal camps, the dues have gone up and disclosed a small round thing, so small as hoarfrost on the ground. There has been manna. A kind government representing the conscience of a nation could do no less than to acknowledge the commonness of fault. This is only just. The specific terms of humanity's contract with nature can be discovered only by adventure, by experiment, and by pioneering. These Jodes were the victim of an attempt at the enlargement of man's kingdom, which failed. Somehow their distress must be relieved. To an extent it was, and already man has returned to the attack, not this time by risking the tender flesh of unready pioneers, but rather by sending out the advance parties of scientific conservation.
Thank you, Mr. Tuttle. I'm told that our second speaker is distinguished for several things, among them for raising prize-winning pears. Mr. Philip Bancroft has been a member of the Executive Committee of the Associated Farmers of California and will describe for us the problems that California has had to face since the Jodes started to arrive. Mr. Bancroft was the Republican candidate for United States Senator from California in 1938. We are particularly happy to welcome him as a new speaker to the Town Hall platform, Mr. Philip Bancroft.
Thank you, Mr. Denny, for that very kind introduction and for mentioning our pears. In discussing this evening's subject, what should America do for the Jodes, I assume that the question means, what should America do for the people from the farms and towns of such states as Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Texas, and that small and much overemphasized district known as the Dust Bowl, who are migrating in such large numbers to California. For the Jodes, as pictured in Mr. Steinbeck's highly sensational and utterly inaccurate work of fiction, are in no sense representatives of the average, thoroughly American family coming from Oklahoma or any other state. This migration and the conditions leading up to it present one of the greatest tragedies in American farm life. And unless something constructive is done to cure its causes, we shall find that migration has barely started. The problem, which is primarily an economic one, will never be solved by name-calling or by attempts to stir up class prejudice. The people who might have helped settle this problem are, first, the representatives of the federal government. Second, those of the several states involved, and third, the California farms and their communities. And of these three, only the California farmers and their communities have done their part. Both the federal government and the states have woefully fallen down on their jobs. In 1935, there began arriving in California alarmingly large numbers of destitute families, lured to our state chiefly by the extremely generous relief payments, and also by the fact that our farm wages are two or three times as high as those of their home states. Our California farmers had no need of any additional laborers. They had not asked these visitors to come into their communities, and they had no housing or school facilities for them or their children. The farmers are in very much the same position as any of you city people would be if you should wake up some morning and find 10 or a dozen families camped on your lawn or on the sidewalk in front of your home, all asking for jobs you didn't have or for relief you couldn't afford to give. Just what would you do? Well, I'll tell you what the California farmers and farm communities did. The people of Kern, Kings, Madera, Fresno, and Tulare counties, who have been bearing the brunt of this migration, found that their fine local schools and their county hospitals, which they had built up at heavy cost, were suddenly swamped by these uninvited guests, who appeared on their doorsteps hungry, homeless, and destitute. These farming communities built additions to their schools and hospitals. They hired additional teachers, nurses, and doctors. In the counties of the great San Joaquin Valley, the local taxes have consequently soared to unbelievable heights. In Kern, the county in which the Jodes finished their imaginary pilgrimage, and in which they were supposed to have been treated so barbarously by the farmers, the local taxes for health, sanitation, charities, and corrections have more than doubled. And the school taxes have almost trebled in the last 5 years, while in Kings and Tulare counties they have almost quadrupled. Please remember that these taxes are paid by the farmers and other property owners, while their farms are worth either no more or actually less than they were worth 5 years ago. These figures are enough to show you that the farmers of California have done all in their power to help these victims of pitifully low farm incomes in their home states. But in spite of this, the problem is no nearer solution today than it was at the beginning. For even if every migrant in California should be provided tomorrow with a house, 5 acres of land, and a mule, next month we'd have 7,000 new migrants asking for relief. And before a year had passed, we'd have 100,000 more. Next, let us consider the states involved. We find that the home states of the migrants have done practically nothing to help out their citizens, except perhaps to encourage them to start migrating to California, while our own state has endangered the relief of our own deserving and needy citizens by throwing our doors wide open to the destitute of the other 47 states and inviting them to enter. With monthly relief doles averaging $3.50 in Oklahoma and $4.68 in Arkansas, our state offers an average of $31.10 per month to these same families if they will only come to California and stay a year. Although we know that by doing so, we are driving our state directly toward bankruptcy. With a direct offer to millions of people of more real money for doing nothing in California than they could hope to make for working back home, and with over 1 million of our California voters promising them $30 every Thursday as soon as they reach the age of 50, the only wonder to me is that there are any farmers or small-town people left back in Oklahoma or Arkansas. I should think that common horse sense and a desire to protect California's own would result in a residence requirement of at least 3, but preferably of 5 years, before a newcomer would be allowed to draw state relief. I cannot too often repeat that this is a national problem, and that either the Resettlement Administration or some other alphabetical national agency should have helped these distressed people to earn their livings back home in their home states, as we California farmers begged them to do years ago. The government can support families much cheaper and better in their home states than after they have started to migrate. But instead of resettling them there, it has unsettled them by encouraging them to come to California, where we have no work for them. Now, in order to discourage indigents from coming out to California and immediately going on relief, we have a regulation requiring them to reside in our state 1 year before they can qualify for state aid. But the National Resettlement Administration has largely nullified the protection afforded through this regulation by giving the migrants federal relief for this first year until they could be shunted on to the California taxpayers. You know, it's always easier to shovel out the federal tax money than to work out a constructive solution. It's no wonder that after a few years of failure, the government changed the name of the Resettlement Administration to the FSA, or Farm Security Administration. But I suggest it would have been far more appropriate if it had changed its name to the MPA, the Migrant Promotion Administration. In conclusion, I want to point out that the California farmers have done their very best to provide out of their own meager resources houses, schools, hospitals, nurses, and doctors for these unfortunates, that they have resisted the opportunity of capitalizing on the presence of over two men for every farm job, and instead of reducing wages, have actually raised them during this period of oversupply of labor and depressed farm prices. That, in fact, California farmers have through the years been paying the highest farm wages of any state in the Union, including, incidentally, your own state of New York. Under these circumstances, I submit that it is about time for the well-paid economists, professors, governmental job holders, and other politicians, as well as our sensational authors, to give up their favorite indoor sport of abusing and sniping at our California farmers, and to do some constructive work to remedy what is, after all, a national economic problem.
Thank you, Mr. Bancroft, for so well stating the California farmer's point of view. Our next speaker is another Californian, Mr. Cary McWilliams, who is perhaps best known to you as the author of the book Factories in the Field, a study of the life among the migrant workers. Last year, Governor Olson made him the chief of the Division of Immigration and Housing of California's Department of Industrial Relations. I take pleasure also in welcoming to our platform Mr. Cary McWilliams.
Out in the San Joaquin Valley, they tell a story. A city man and a farmer were walking along a railroad track one day when they saw a man in rags going along ahead of them. "Who is that tramp?" asked the city man. His farmer friend replied, "Why, that is no tramp. That man is a pea picker." A few months later, when the harvest was over, these same friends saw the same lonely figure walking along the tracks, but headed out of the valley this time. The city man inquired, "Who is that pea picker?" The farmer replied, "That's no pea picker. That's a tramp." Today we have in California about 300,000 migratory workers who are prized as pea pickers, so to speak, for 6 months of the year, but regarded as little more than tramps for the rest of the year. We call these workers the Joads, after the family that John Steinbeck has made famous in The Grapes of Wrath. Now these Joads, the Joads, are not tramps at all. A tramp is a man who does not want to work at any time, while the Joads, the migratory workers, are anxious to work. It is only because they earn so little for the time that they do work that they have to live like tramps the rest of the year. California has long had a migratory labor problem, but until the arrival of the Joads, this type of labor was made up of foreign-born groups. While these foreign workers were often cruelly exploited, no one paid much attention to them. The Joads, however, are American citizens, people of our flesh and blood. The Joad Army, moreover, is made up of families in quest of permanent settlement, and not by single men in quest of seasonal employment. Stranded in California, their living conditions are extremely wretched. They need food, clothing, shelter, and medical care. Various governmental agencies are assisting thousands of these families, but large numbers of them, by reason of technicalities concerning residence, cannot qualify for any type of relief. Migration in quest of economic opportunity is deeply rooted in American life. Most Californians are migrants themselves. And we forget sometimes that the alternative to free migration is to rivet the individual to one locality. Americans are not yet prepared, I take it, to concede that they must stay in some one state until permission is given them to move elsewhere. Calling out the National Guard to stem the tide of migrants into California is no answer to this problem, nor is it an answer to prosecute a man, as is done nowadays in California, for bringing indigent relatives into the state. Agriculture in California is big business, not a mode of living. We have thousands of family-sized farms, but the significant California farm is the large-scale industrialized corporate farm. We have over one-third of all the large-scale farms in the United States, and it is these farms that employ practically all of our migratory workers. These farm factories are operated by resident managers. They employ 2,000 and 3,000 workers. Their annual payrolls amount in some instances to nearly $1 million. Nor do these great farms stand alone. They are banded together in an organization known as the Associated Farmers, which to date has been pretty largely financed by railroad, banking, utility, cannery, and cotton ginning companies. Under these circumstances, what should America do for the Joes? First, I think Congress should appoint a committee on agricultural labor and interstate migration to study all of the ramifications of this basic social problem. Second, the federal government should reestablish, perhaps on a new basis, the Federal Transient Service, which was discontinued in 1935 when the Dust Bowl migration was at its peak. Congressman Jerry Voorhees has already introduced legislation which, if enacted, would result in the federal government again assuming some measure of responsibility for migrants who have lost residence in one state but have not acquired residence in another. Third, the employers of migratory labor should be made to assume a larger measure of responsibility for the welfare of their employees. Our farm factories should be brought within the provisions of such federal legislation as the wage and hours, unemployment insurance, old age pension, and National Labor Relations Act. This legislation can be extended in such a manner that it will not add any additional burden to the small farmer, who, please remember, employs practically no labor. Fourth, I think the Joes should organize, and that we should make it possible for them to organize. When farmers organize to protect the price of milk, oranges, or potatoes, they are doing precisely what a trade union does when it organizes workers to protect the price of the only commodity its members have to sell, namely their labor. Organization is particularly necessary in California, where the large-scale farms are united for the purpose of keeping wage rates as low as possible. Those who have followed the United States Senate investigation in California know what happens at present when farm workers attempt to organize. I cannot, therefore, overemphasize the necessity for the protection of the civil liberties of migratory workers. Fifth, the Joes should be given a chance to do some farming of their own. I thoroughly approve of the program of the Farm Security Administration, designed to give the Joes a new start in farming under competent technical guidance. But the Joes should be taught a new technique, the technique of large-scale cooperative farming, of the type that is now being successfully practiced on Farm Security Administration projects in California and Arizona. Wherever industrialized agriculture of the type that has become entrenched in California comes into existence, you may expect to find an army of migratory workers employed for a few months of the year at extremely low wages and supported, if at all, by a miserable dole in the off-season period. Unless corrected, this development makes for peasantry. The Committee on Farm Tenancy in 1937 observed with deep concern, quote, an increasing tendency for the rungs of the ladder in agricultural employment to become bars, forcing imprisonment in a fixed social status from which it is increasingly difficult to escape. Should the rungs of the agricultural ladder become rigid between classes, an American ideal would be lost. In a community of rigid social groups, normal democratic processes are unable to function, end quote. The Joes are struggling against these bars. They must be given a way out. Basically, this way out lies in the direction of the Joes taking their place in the ranks of American labor in its fight for economic security. This question might be phrased another way. Instead of what should America do for the Joes, it might be stated, what can the Joes do for America? I know a great many of the Joes in California, know them, like them, and respect them. if given a chance, they will make an important contribution to our American democracy. So long as we hold America to be free and democratic, we cannot continue to allow a large body of our most honest and industrious citizens to lead a life that is half peon and half tramp.
WJZ, New York.
This is America's Town Meeting of the Air, continuing our discussion of the question, what should America do for the Jodes and other migrant families of the far west? Our program would be incomplete without our fourth speaker, who is the chief of the United States Soil Conservation Service, who will tell us of the conditions that first forced the Jodes to move away from Arkansas and those other Dust Bowl areas, and what he thinks can be done about them. Mr. Bennett.
Among the forces that conspired to pauperize thousands of American farmers, undermine their morale, drive them from their farms, and put them on the highways as wandering Jodes, none is more basic than the gross wastage of good productive soil. That is what you would expect me to say. I have been working with the soil all my life. My job is soil conservation. No matter how you look at it, good productive soil is the source of our food and clothing and much of our shelter. And it's as vital to city people as to the farmer. Good soil is the basic capital of every farmer and the one indispensable resource of the nation. We have been amazingly wasteful of this resource. We have permitted erosion to remove more soil in fewer years than any other nation in history. Here is what has happened to our soil within little more than a century. We have either ruined or damaged more than half the land in the United States. We have allowed erosion to ruin, for any further practical cultivation, about 50 million acres of once productive cropland. Another 50 million acres of cropland are nearly as bad off. Those trying to eke out a living on such land haven't the slightest chance to make ends meet. They are bankrupt farmers on bankrupt land, promising prospects, every one of them, for the role of the Jodes. In colonial time, America was covered with a good 9 inches of productive topsoil on the average. Today, the average depth of topsoil across the country is only about 5 inches, nearly half of it gone. That is the average. On tens of thousands of acres, all the productive topsoil is gone, and it cannot be restored. All that's left is stubborn subsoil, raw material from which real soil is formed by nature over hundreds of years. In addition, millions of gullies now split the land. Raw gulches that were not here when white men took over the land from the Indians. All this is vitally important in any consideration of what America should do for the Jodes. I am pretty sure, for instance, that erosion has caused more families to leave eastern Oklahoma, the home of the Jodes, than any other one thing. The goals towards which we as a nation are working are opportunity and security, a better way of life. I want to emphasize that security of our physical resources is essential to human security. Let me illustrate. In 1936, soil conservation demonstrations were started in the Dust Bowl to help farmers control erosion, stop dust storms, and establish the best possible use of the land. These projects now cover many thousands of acres in the wind erosion section of Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Colorado, New Mexico. Although the work has been carried on during a period of dust storms, drought, and depression, while many farmers were migrating, only 14 of 495 cooperating farmers in 10 of the Dust Bowl counties gave up and moved away. From 7 of the projects, not a single farmer abandoned his land to augment the mounting lists of dispossessed people. the Jones. On the other hand, 1,202 farm families in the same 10 counties not cooperating in this conservation work abandoned their farms and moved out. Those who stayed did not stay simply because the soil on their farms had been tied down against the ravages of the wind. Their decision to remain went deeper. It was founded on a renewed and, I believe, justifiable feeling of opportunity and security. It is true the conservation work protected their basic capital, the soil, and brought increased yield. But it did more. It set up in the minds and hearts of these men and women a new outlook on life. They are now less likely to leave for other pastures, however green they may be reported. The farmers in trouble today, not all lazy or incompetent, the majority are hardworking and sincere. They want to do something for themselves, anything that will cure the ills of their harassed land and improve an economic system that has gone awry in their individual lives. Soil conservation is something they can get their teeth into. With a little technical help, they can protect their land and conserve rainfall for crop use. When that is done, they have a far better chance to make a living where they are. Many of the present problems can be traced directly to the one crop system that puts whole farms solidly in wheat or cotton or corn. When a farmer stakes everything on a single crop, he has no cushion to relieve this shock of drought and low prices. All his eggs are in one basket. Planting an entire farm to a single cash crop is usually as hazardous to soil resources as to economic welfare. That is why the farm conservation plan, as it is developed today, almost always calls for diversification of crops. The conservation farm also improves conditions for poultry and livestock by providing more feed, and he is almost sure to have a garden and usually a cow. He's not likely to buy all his meat, milk, eggs, and potatoes from the grocery store in town or to go entirely without them. His farm tends to become more nearly self-sufficient. Near Muskogee in eastern Oklahoma, the Soil Conservation Service has worked since 1936 with 211 farmers. Most of them were one-year tenants at the start, without credit at any bank. Today, every one of these farmers can get credit when needed. Instead of moving from place to place every year, having no real home, knowing no security, these people now have a place to call home. They have a longer tenure and a considerable degree of security. Many of them can now buy the farms they operate. Soil conservation work has been their salvation. If we have many more years of needless land mistreatment, such as we have just gone through, with 500,000 acres of crop land being ruined every year, this country will be brought to a point of critical insecurity. Additional thousands of displaced farmers will be seeking a place to live. Recent experience has shown that soil erosion can be controlled by the use of practical farm measures, and that the economic situation on millions of farms can be improved by this kind of way. It seems to me it would be the poorest kind of business management not to go ahead and do the necessary work of soil conservation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bennett. It would seem clear to all of us after these presentations that this problem can't be solved on the basis of political expediency or our own prejudices. We must look the issues square in the face and consider them with the same degree of impartiality that the scientist considers his problems as he goes into his laboratory. Now we are ready for the question period from an audience of 1,500 representative Americans, more than 60% of whom have never been to a town meeting before. Will you please rise, state the name of the person to whom your question is directed. Questions, please. We'll start with the man in the balcony. Yes?
Mr. McWilliams. Would it not be best to tax land values so that the speculative owners of speculative land be forced either to use it or to let it out of production to these farmers? Would it not be best to tax land values so that the owners of speculative land would either be forced to use it or else to give it, to let it out to other people who can use it?
I'm glad to have at least one Henry George question. The answer, in my judgment, is yes. The state of California, the relief burden referred to by Mr. Bancroft, is sustained by a state system of taxation. System of taxation, 53% of which is derived by a sales tax borne by the metropolitan residents in large part of San Francisco and Los Angeles at the present time, and not by the large landowners of California.
Thank you. Just a minute before you go, here's a written question from Mr. E.H. Anger of Framingham, Massachusetts, to Mr. McWilliams. Is the Grapes of Wrath a true picture of conditions that really existed or now exist in the West?
In response to that question, I would say this, that with respect to the time that Mr. Steinbeck first went into the fields in California in 1937, the Grapes of Wrath is a very substantially true and accurate condition of migratory labor in California.
I'm going to ask Mr. Bancroft to speak to that same question.
I'll say that the Grapes of Wrath is an absolutely untrue and libelous book, and it libels not only the farmers of California. You can hiss all you want. After you've lived in this country a little longer, you'll understand American principles of fair play. Now I'll say that Grapes of Wrath is not only a libel on the farmers and the good people of California, but it's a still worse libel on those fellow farmers who come from what they call the Dust Bowl. Most of them don't come from the Dust Bowl, by the way, but those people who are good, hard-working Americans and who were driven out of their farms through the failure of our wonderful farm relief that we were going to have and Secretary Wallace's agricultural policy.
Well, I forgot to ask this audience not to hiss and boo, please. If you must disagree with the speaker, you may shout no, but just... All right. We got it. Thank you. Some of you disagree and some of you agree. Well, that's the way it should be in a town meeting. Next question, please.
I'm also from California, Mr. McWilliams and Mr. Bancroft. I want to ask Mr. McWilliams. Mr. McWilliams apparently wants the federal government to apply the minimum wage law to farmers. He also apparently wants an NLRB for farmers. Mr. Bancroft has stated that wages are higher in farm communities in California than they are in other portions of the United States. It's also my understanding that relief in California is 7 or 8 times that offered in Oklahoma or Arkansas. How would Mr. McWilliams organize a federal minimum wage law which would benefit California on that basis? And if that has happened...
Let's stick to that one question. All right, Mr. McWilliams, that's enough. Thank you.
My answer to that is twofold. In the first place, this notion that farm wage rates are higher in California than they are elsewhere is so much folklore. The figures upon which Mr. Bancroft bases that statement are based upon wages with room and board, and also daily wage rates. Now, the migratory workers of California never receive board, and they are never paid on a daily wage base. They are paid on hourly or a piece rate, and the figures that he is talking about have relation to not more than 20% of all workers who are employed in California agriculture. Now, with respect to the higher relief rates in California, let me say this, that California also has a higher per capita distribution of wealth. And when you compare that higher per capita distribution of wealth with Oklahoma and Arkansas, you can see we're paying just about what we should pay and no more. Thank you. Mr. Bancroft, you comment on that.
That Mr. McWilliams, I'm sorry to say, disagrees with the federal census figures. And he's absolutely wrong. The trouble is, Mr. McWilliams has spent so much time doing politics that he hasn't had time enough to do farming. Now, I'll read you the federal figures. They are both with board and without. And they show that without board, in the east, south, central states, the average wage is $1.04. In California, it's $2.80. In the South Atlantic states, it's $1.20. In California, it's $2.80. In the West, South, Central states, it's $1.26. In California, it's $2.80. And now they also give the wages with board. I see a lot of you want to hiss again. Go ahead. And they give the wages with board, and they also show that with board, California is running $2.05 average, while those other states run 81 cents, 90 cents, and a dollar. Now, so much for those prices. Thank you.
Mr. McWilliams, do you want to comment on that, or let's go? All right. These rates, the other rates quoted by Mr. Bancroft, are, again, I insist, rates of pay per day. Now, California migratory workers are not paid on daily rates. They're paid per 100 pounds of picking cotton. They're paid per hourly rate in their other occupations. And these rates, as shown by the GNNE Foundation of the University of California, do not apply to more than 20% of all farm workers in California.
All right, thank you. Mr. Bancroft?
This is another point on which Mr. McWilliams, through his youth and lack of experience, doesn't understand. The piecework in California, the amount paid, runs very much higher on the average than the daily wages. We've had men working for us that make $6, $8, $10, and $12 a day, and there are migratory workers that make very many of them $4.50 and $5 a day, and we can't get them when we want to pay $3 a day because they go to the districts where they can do piecework. They, almost all of them, prefer to do piecework, the good workers, than to do day work.
All right. Next question.
Mr. Bancroft. A California farmer was quoted in Monday's New York Times as saying that Californian agriculture without the federal subsidies to agriculture would be practically bankrupt, that it was getting on as it is today. Now, if those subsidies were withdrawn, what would be the effect on migrations to California?
All right. Mr. Bancroft.
Well, I think right now that most California farmers are only about three jumps ahead of the sheriff, and it wouldn't take much more, and these Oklahomans realize it wouldn't take much more for most of us to be forced off our farms and have to be ready to migrate somewhere else to try to get jobs. So whether the federal relief is withdrawn or not, it's only a drop in the bucket when it comes to paying these wages. And we're not dependent on federal relief. What we want is to get a chance to work out our own destiny without having to support the migrants from the other 47 states of the Union.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Well, I want a question for another speaker. You got a question for another speaker back there? Yes? What?
Mr. McWilliams,
all right.
Try to
keep
the
things in balance.
How does the annual agricultural wages in California compare with that in other states?
Yes. How does the annual wage for the workers in California compare with that in other states?
Well, the State Relief Administration in California has made a number of elaborate studies which show that the annual earnings of migratory workers in California range from about $275 to $300 per year. Mr. Bancroft previously stated that California had a one-year residence requirement for relief. I want to correct that in part by saying that the last special session of the legislature in California, which adjourned about 2 weeks ago, the residence requirement was lifted to 3 years for relief in California.
Thank you. Next question.
I might ask Mr. Tugwell a question. I'd like to know if Mr. Tugwell thinks there is anything which can be done in the field of vocational training and vocational guidance for the young men and women who are in the federal camps.
Yes, I think very definitely that it can. The people who are in the federal camps, so far as my experience with them goes, have every indication of being some of the best stock in the United States. And all they lack is training. And I'm sure that a great many of them, especially the younger ones, could be retrained for many other opportunities which might open up. However, the older people are very difficult to retrain because they've been used to farming all their lives and farming on a small scale at that. And under those conditions, it's very difficult to invent a retraining program which will be of any immediate benefit to them. The only thing that we've been able to think of in connection with the camps in California is to try to start them on the ladder of agricultural progress. To do that, we have, in connection with some of the camps, established first small homesteads immediately surrounding some of the camps, and then made it possible for them through some of the other federal loan programs to get larger farms of a family size later on. This, we hope, may start even some of the older people on the agricultural ladder, as it's called.
Thank you, sir. Next question.
Yes, Professor Douglas is this time.
Isn't it true that some state legislatures ignore this problem because the Jotes do not constitute a large voting bloc? Poll taxes disfranchise them and deny them representation in the state legislatures.
Will you comment on that question, Mr. Temple?
I notice that my friend Mayor Maury Maverick of San Antonio, a day or two ago, said some things about the poll tax which were extremely uncomplimentary. And they've been said by Southern statesmen before of liberal persuasion. I think the implications of your question are quite true.
Thank you. The lady.
That's why both Mr. McWilliams and Mr. Bancroft.
All right.
What is the organization of the Associated Farmers?
Oh, well, let's Mr. Bancroft start, and then you can comment on it. Mr. Bancroft. What is the organization of the Associated Farmers?
I would be very glad to tell you what the organization of the Associated Farmers is. It is the most representative organization of farmers in the state of California and the largest. It includes in its membership almost all the leading members of the Farm Bureau, the Grange, and the Farmers Union. It is composed, contrary to the statements that have been made here this evening, of 90% of men, farmers, whom even Mr. McWilliams would be forced to admit are small farmers. Right from the beginning, it has worked to fight against those who are trying to take away from us our homes, our farms, and trying to push us off our farms and to create great socialized farms similar to those of Russia. And I want to point out, now just 1 minute, I want to point out what Mr. McWilliams said in his book on this very subject, and it's a good book you might read, called Factories in the Field. He says, quote, "The real solution involves the substitution of collective agriculture for the present monopolistically owned and controlled system. As a first step in the direction of collectivization, the agricultural workers must be organized. And then a little further, he says, but the final solution will come only when the present wasteful, vicious, undemocratic, and thoroughly antisocial system of agricultural ownership in California is abolished.
Mr. Williams, you want to comment on that?
Yes, I'd like to comment on that. Out of $180,000 contributed to the Associated Farmers of California between 1934 and 1939, exactly 20% came from farmers. In Los Angeles County in 1938, $2 came from actual farmers. The balance of it came from the type of corporations that I mentioned previously. Now, the Associated Farmers have as their objective but one purpose, and that is to prevent the organization of agricultural workers. To achieve that purpose, they have frequently and notoriously violated the civil liberties of agricultural workers in California, going so far, ladies and gentlemen, as to organize private armies in the San Joaquin Valley of California, providing for the type of uniform, the type of helmet, the type of sidearm to be worn by their so-called private armies, their little Hitler armies in the San Joaquin Valley of California.
I wish we could go on, but our time is almost up, and we must turn this over to our listening audience for the discussion of the Jodes and their problems. Let me urgently recommend to all of you that you subscribe to the Town Meeting Bulletin, at least, that you read our bibliography and read further on this subject. Now, I want to call your attention to those of you who regularly enjoy these Thursday evening meetings, a way in which you can assist us. Tell us in a letter of not more than 500 words just how Town Hall can best aid in creating an honestly informed public opinion in America. That's the all-important job for 1940. You know, Town Hall is now approaching the 50th anniversary of its founding, and we want to celebrate that anniversary by tremendously increasing the usefulness to America of the work that we are doing. We want your suggestions. The listener who sends the most helpful letter will be brought to New York as our guest early next season for an appearance on this program.
Basic information about Town Hall's 50th anniversary program is contained in the bulletin, Town Meeting. Copies giving a complete account of tonight's broadcast can be purchased for 10 cents, or for $2.50, a set of 26 reporting on all the broadcasts of this current season. Send your orders to Town Hall, 123 West 43rd Street, New York City.
The topic we consider next week is one very close to the hearts of everyone today. How can philosophy and religion meet today's needs? We are proud to announce that we have secured as speakers Dr. Harry A. Overstreet, distinguished philosopher and member of our Board of Trustees, Dr. Reinhold Niebuhr of Union Theological Seminary, Dr. Irving Edmund of Columbia University and author of Philosopher's Holiday, and Father Martin Darcy of Oxford, England, visiting professor at Fordham University. And as our special guest, Mr. G. Aubrey Young, the writer of the prize-winning essay in the contest conducted last fall by Town Hall, What Does American Democracy Mean to Me? This meeting has been arranged in cooperation with the Phi Beta Kappa Society of America, and we'll be glad to welcome several hundred Phi Beta Kappa chapters to our growing number of listening groups. Members of our radio audience who cannot attend the broadcast, but who would like to address particular questions to speakers, are invited to get those questions to Town Hall before Thursday noon of next week.
So be sure to listen. Next week, same time, same station, for the sound of the crier's bell.
How can philosophy and religion meet today's needs?
This program has come to you from Town Hall, New York. It has been a public service feature of the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company and its associated stations.